Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Living as an expatriate, writes Alice Kaplan, is to experience an echo chamber where one national experience could inform another. The country of origin could be better understood from outside than from within. To talk with me about how transformative and insightful the experience of exile can be is Alice Kaplan, John M. Mooser Professor of French at Yale University and Chair of the Yale Department of French. Kaplan established her academic cred with a number of books on French fascism before writing her crossover acclaimed memoir, French Lessons. Her most recent book is Dreaming in French, The Paris Years of Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, Susan Sontag, and Angela Davis, which she'll be discussing at Rhodes College on February 11th at 7 p.m. Alice, thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Alice, in French Lessons, you talk about being born in the 1950s and growing up in a white bread Minneapolis neighborhood in a family that in one generation had shed all aspects of their immigrant Jewish origins. At 15, you were sent to boarding school in Switzerland to get over your father's death. And you discuss how learning French as an expat saved you from the depths of despair. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing, your father, and how your French lessons allowed you to become someone else for just long enough to discover who you were.
I like that phrase, becoming someone else to become oneself. I think I was like many adolescents. You know, it's a time of life where people are very focused on themselves and often find an intense passion. For many girls, it's horses. For me, it was that really physical sensation of leaving my own language and being sent away to a school where I would lie in my bunk bed at night and hear the women, the young girls speaking in all different languages. It gave me a time out from everything that I didn't understand that was going on in my own family, the death of a parent, the departure of my siblings from college, a kind of restlessness in me, and the breakdown of rituals in a family that had always had comforting rituals. And what I found in this Swiss school were rituals that were both annoying and very comforting. I think that young people do need a certain number of boundaries. And certainly the French education system, the Swiss education system, had those boundaries that I could rebel against and also take comfort in.
Now, you were there because your father had passed away. He was a prosecutor at Nuremberg, the trial that put some of the leading Nazis on trial in the immediate aftermath of the war. Tell us a little bit about your father and about the experience of that loss and how the experience you just narrated about being at the school in Switzerland helped you to deal with that.
You know, I've seen this in many writers who have lost a parent at a young age. Many writers and historians, it tends to make people into passionate archival researchers. When you lose somebody young like that, you tend to imagine their life. You tend to continue a relationship with them in your imagination. I think that's true for many people. It certainly was true for me. And what I had left of my father after his death when I was 7 was in the form of archives. I found letters. I found pictures. I actually found some very disturbing pictures of concentration camps that somehow ended up in his files, his letters home from Nuremberg. I became really fascinated by the experience he had had, always regretted that I was too young to talk to him about it, and became myself an historian specializing in that period. And now I like to say that, you know, I've finally graduated beyond 1945, and now I'm really enjoying working on the post-war world.
Well, it's very interesting that you talk about an archive, a place where these remnants of the past remain, and the way in which you can go and revisit the past through an archive. I guess I want to talk a little bit more about a different kind of archive, Alice. You're now teaching at Yale, where you went to graduate school in the very heady days of the 1970s, when the word deconstruction was on the lips of every graduate student. Tell us a little bit about why deconstructing texts was such an exciting way to approach literature, and about studying with one of deconstruction's great luminaries, Paul de Man. And then tell us a little bit about the explosion in academic life when it was discovered that there was an archive. There were remains, residues of what de Man had written on the eve of the Second World War a series of articles in a pro-Nazi journal, and what your whole role was within the Paul DeMond affair that emerged.
You know, it's a very complicated story that's certainly worthy of a novel. Paul DeMond was a charismatic, brilliant teacher who taught his students to read very, very carefully, always looking for the logical break or the point in the text where the language betrays itself and shows you there's something going on. And I think in general, those years, the 70s, those were years of great vigilance. I mean, after all, we had survived these surprise assassinations, and I had survived the death of a parent. Deconstruction reading was the reading of people who were not trusting in the world. And I often think that if DeMond worked towards that kind of deconstructive reading, it was because he himself no longer trusted the official discourse after what he had lived through in occupied Belgium. He, as a very young man, had gone to work for a newspaper that collaborated with the Nazis, Le Soir. His uncle, Henri DeMond, was the head of the Socialist Party, the major theoretician of the Socialist Party in Belgium, who had a politics of collaboration. You know, when I talk to World War II specialists about the DeMond case, those of them who have read the few anti-Semitically shaded articles that DeMond wrote as a young man, they say, are you kidding? You guys made a big scandal about this? This is like the most conventional language that practically every intellectual in an occupied country in Europe was using. But, you know, things are different here, and I think one of the things that so shocked people was that DeMond had never talked about what he had experienced. He obviously believed that if he had, it would have blocked his career. I mean, I can't go back in his head and describe the anguish he must have felt. But in any case, it was a secret. It may have been an open secret for several people. But when I found it, I felt suddenly, I guess authorized is too strong a word, but I felt a duty to go back to those original articles and try to put them in the context of the work I had already been doing on fascism. It was just an accident, one of those strange accidents of life that the chair of the department where I had been a graduate student had the very experience I would have loved to hear about from him, about living in an occupied country and writing for this newspaper. So I wrote an article in a whole series of articles about DeMond, Le Soir, the Affaire DeMond. And it really turned me, it gave me permission to be the archival researcher that I had always been, in fact, in my private life since the death of my father. And it was after that that I wrote the book about Robert Brasillach, the collaborationist journalist who was executed for Nazi treason in France in 1945.
I do want to talk about the Brasillach book, but before we turn away from Paul DeMond, I also want to give listeners a little bit more of a sense of why this was such a huge affair. DeMond was not the only silent intellectual in the post-war period about the role that he had played during the war. Of course, the other great figure was Heidegger, and Heidegger had been the most prominent philosopher in Germany who had also collaborated with the Nazis.
You know, I got to interrupt you there, Jonathan, because the comparison between DeMond, who was, you know, really young, had no power, was writing a few articles, you know, none of which had any impact, and Heidegger, who was the rector of a major German university, who was a phenomenally powerful individual at the height of his powers and so on, there's no comparison between those two figures. Perhaps there is a comparison in the minds of young American students in the 1970s coming to terms with these things.
And I guess now already you can see that the passions begin to flare around this, and these were precisely the comparisons. And what you insisted on was putting this into context and appreciating the kinds of choices that people made, which were very, very specific and needed to be understood in the very specific kinds of frames in which they took place. And this seemed to be quite different from what deconstruction, at least, was doing in relationship to text. So I just want to talk about one comparison that we can make between them, and that is the kind of charisma that each of them had as teachers and the ways in which they seemed to bring texts alive that made them so powerful for the students who were around them and who were studying with them. Using that as a kind of leaping off point, tell us just a little bit more about what deconstruction is, because I know for some people listening, that's not even going to be a word that's a part of their vocabulary, or the ways in which they use it is not at all in accord with the
I
way.
Don't know. I think one of the things that's been very amusing for me, you know, since the 1970s is seeing the way that word deconstruction has spread. On election night this year, I heard the pundit from ABC saying, let's deconstruct those election returns in Ohio. And that turned out to mean, let's look at the Ohio returns county by county. I mean, the word has just come to mean a really intense focus on something. To get back to your question and the question of politics, I actually see things a little differently with de Man and deconstruction. I see deconstruction as his response to being involved in this terrible world of occupied Europe. I see deconstruction as his attempt to free his reading from ideology. Now, perhaps it failed, but it was not a political form of reading. It was a vigilant form of reading. And I think one of the things that was so dismaying about students of deconstruction when the scandal happened was that there were so many black and white reactions. And you could read things where people said, deconstructionism is Nazism. It was really pretty insane. So again, what you say about putting things into context, yes, it's so important. And to see things in the gray and not in the black and white.
And I think one of the things I really love about your work is that not only do you reinsert things into their context and insist that what's going on historically and politically and socially is really, really important, but you bring with you all of the tools of a literary critic. So you're deeply sensitive to the very specific ways in which language operates in different kinds of moments. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the ways in which you've done that with respect to other fascist intellectuals. So you brought up your book on Brasillach. I want to focus a little bit more on The Collaborator, which is about the trial and execution of Robert Brasillach. He was executed for treason at 35 by a firing squad, the only writer of distinction put to death by the liberation government, when others who had the blood of those who had been killed by the fascists directly on their hands, those responsible for the murder of thousands, were set free. Why? In what ways was the Brasillach trial a kind of symbolic reckoning for post-war France?
Let me just add one little footnote to what you said. You made a transition with other fascist intellectuals. I don't consider Paul Dumont a fascist intellectual at all. I consider him a young man who made some bad judgment in writing some cliched pieces for Le Soir. On the other hand, Brasillach, definitely a passionate fascist intellectual who actually believed in, you know, what for him was this joyous ideology of Nazism, who was committed to anti-Semitic thinking. He was the perfect exemplary case for a France coming out of the war that badly needed to rebuild itself. It needed its civil servants. It needed its administrative infrastructure. It needed the people who had built the Atlantic Wall for the Germans to be building new things to reconstruct this bombed out country. Whereas there he was, kind of pure, and you could take him to trial on the basis of a file of newspaper clippings in which again and again he denounced people. He sang the praises of the Nazis. He was incredibly eloquent. His trial was what the French would call a concours d'éloquence. It was an amazing, theatrical moment in post-war France. People always say if his lawyer had only delayed, you know, 6 months, a year, if he could have drawn things out, they wouldn't have executed him. But it was one of the very first trials, and people needed somebody to die, and it was Brasillach.
So let's talk a little bit more about the different sides around the trial and some of the theater of what ended up happening. One of the things that emerged was a debate about whether or not Brasillach should be killed or whether an amnesty should be put on that, right? Or a limit put on that. Tell us a little bit about why that was a debate. Here was someone whose newspaper denounced Jews, who advocated Nazism or fascist ideals. Je suis partout published the addresses of people. So it was a...
That's right. And he was the editor-in-chief of that newspaper for quite a while. You know, the thing that's so great about that debate is it's really a debate about whether words count. It's, of course, not a debate we would have had in this country because of First Amendment rights. But it was a debate about whether somebody's words could be directly responsible for deaths of people. what's the relationship between words and acts? And it was quite a dilemma for other writers, because by saying that Brasillach should die, they were saying that words mattered. And there are some people that will tell you that that's the last time in French history where words really mattered, that now you would never have a death sentence based on somebody's journalism, and that in some way it marks a kind of falling away of the importance of writing, the importance of literature. I'd say it's also really the disillusion of the intellectuals with the whole process of the purge. I mean, after this happened, people were frightened to put this young man to death after a six-hour trial. It just seemed really, really out of control, especially since, as you say, so many people with the political power in occupied France were not put on trial. In fact, were not trialed until 50, 60 years after the fact.
So tell us a little bit more then just about the devastation of France, the experience of the French under the Nazi jackboot, about this immediate post-war period, 50,000 or so trials, 1,500 people, I think it is, that are condemned to death, mm-hmm. and then Brasillach's kind of trial a little bit in the middle. So give us mm-hmm. a fuller sense of the context.
You know, it's very hard to measure. There have been so many phases of historiography about the Vichy period. There was a sense right after the war that everybody had resisted. Then my generation, the post-68 generation, very vigilant, very suspicious of authority, started turning their attention to collaboration and really seeing the depths of collaboration. Then there was a generation of historians who said, well, you know, you shouldn't be so black and white. There were some people who simply accommodated. 75,000 Jews were deported from France. Very few survived. There was the horrible roundup of the children and foreign Jews in Paris in 42, the Veldiv roundup, from which very, very few survived. At the same time, I believe that the French saved more Jews. There are incredible stories of saving children. There's the Protestant town of Chambon-sur-Lignon. There was a very powerful resistance movement, resistance press that changed the whole post-war journalism climate. So it's quite complicated to calibrate all of this. And Brasillach, as somebody who had gone to the elite schools and was still attracted to fascism, he was something really important because he came from the heart of the French elite. He wasn't an accident. He wasn't, in some ways, I think Sartre said that being a collaborator meant being some kind of a pervert or meant being a foreigner. But no, he was right in the heart of things.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judakin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm talking to Alice Kaplan, and we're going to transition now to talk about her newest book, Dreaming in French, The Paris Years of Jacqueline Bouvier-Kennedy, Susan Sontag, and Angela Davis. Alice, in this new book, you kind of pick up on the threads of what you explored in the immediate post-war period. You take us out of the 1930s and 1940s and into post-war France, and you do so from a very different angle. This time, it's about the experience of Americans in Paris, whose lives were changed by their study abroad experience, and who returned to America to, in turn, become change agents. It seems to me the structure of the book is really a key to all the intersecting strands you explore in the book. So in the case of Jackie Kennedy, Susan Sontag, and Angela Davis, you have a chapter about each on their year abroad in Paris, and then a chapter about life upon their return. How does this setup allow you to explore the various themes that you wanted to write about in Dreaming in French?
Well, as I said before, you know, I was eager to get beyond World War II. And there is a transition book that I published in 2005 called The Interpreter. I worked on a French writer named Louis Guillou, who had served as an interpreter for American Army courts-martial in Brittany. And I loved working on two different national archives. And that was a thrill I had again in Dreaming in French. What I wanted to do was return to the themes of French lessons, return to the theme of American women passionately drawn to France, to the French language, but look this time outside myself. So I hunted around for three women whose experiences would be exemplary, who themselves were exemplary women. Not ordinary women on junior year abroad, but women who really took what France gave them and used it, as you say, I like your phrase, agents of change, took what France gave them home and did something to the United States, changed us because of what France had given them. And I picked a kind of a trinity of identity politics, if you like. I mean, there was the Catholic upper class debutante from Newport, Jackie Bouvier, and then this very middle class, lower middle class young woman from Los Angeles and Arizona, Susan Sontag, and an African American woman from Birmingham, Alabama. They were born not at the same time, they're not the same exact generation, but they all discovered France in the post-war years. And it was very fascinating to see that they could find the same pleasure in France, but experience it differently. You can't go to France without loving food. So Angela Davis found her way to the really interesting couscous restaurants of the Quartier Latin. That would not have been the case for Jackie Kennedy. They all loved Proust. Who knew that Proust had something very specific for each of them? For Jackie Kennedy, eventually she would read Proust on her husband's political campaign trail. It helped her figure out the power struggles in his administration. Sontag read Proust as an adolescent in love, this unhappy lesbian love affair she had in Paris in 1957. Angela Davis learned a lot from Proust about racial prejudice. There it is. So, like the milk commercial that I think was eventually outlawed because of lactose, you really can say that France has something for everybody.
And that's one of the great things about the book, is you not only chose three very, very different American women from three different generations, but they also lived in different Frances and they experienced different Frances. And in a sense, that's another character that's in the book. France is there, both imaginary France, the France of dreams, but also real France. So tell us about how the character of France changed in the post-war period and developed in the three generations that are represented by these three women, as well as the ways in which, since they were such different women, they experienced very different aspects of French life.
Yes. They hung out in different places. And of course, France is my glue. I got a letter from a theater producer when the book came out saying, wouldn't you like to write a play where Jackie Bouvier, Susan Sontag, and Angela Davis share an apartment in Paris? And the idea really made me laugh. Because in fact, the whole point is they were not sharing an apartment in Paris. They were in different neighborhoods with different interests. They found their way to very different places. I concentrated on Paris. Paris changed quite a lot between 1949, when Jackie Bouvier went there, and 1963, when Angela Davis went. Jacqueline Bouvier's Paris was really practically a wartime Paris. She had to have a ration card for coffee and sugar. She was there actually the same time Julia Child was in Paris. And when you see the movie about Julia Child, you don't understand how dark and sooty, you know, the buildings were just dark and people were in mourning and people were thin. And Jackie Bouvier was living with a survivor of Ravensbrück who was trying to remake her life and who was renting rooms. She was an aristocrat who had been an aristocratic réseau during the war, had been deported. Her husband had died in deportation. And that was the atmosphere for Jackie Bouvier, who visited Dachau on her Christmas vacation. Sontag, completely different, very self-absorbed, fleeing husband and young child because she had married too young, and finding herself in a very bohemian Paris composed almost entirely of Americans, knowing very, very little French. So it's ironic that she became the expert on France after she went back to the United States. But she helps us understand that Paris of maids' rooms and cheap hotels where so many American writers, I think of Ginsberg, who was in her crowd, among others, so many American writers found a place where they could express themselves with more freedom than at home. And then Angela Davis, there she was in 1963, and the first thing that happened to her when she got to Biarritz for her stage before going up to Paris was she opened the Herald Tribune and saw that the church in her neighborhood had been bombed and children she knew were killed in that church bombing. So there she was, knowing that there was a very violent civil rights battle going on at home and having to be away from it and having that distance, that angry distance that allowed her to see, to understand the struggle she was going to become involved with for the rest of her life.
Well, I'm so glad you've at least given us a kind of point of entry and a short glimpse of what you explore in so much detail in the book. We don't have time to go into each of the vignettes of each of the stories separately, but since you ended on Angela Davis, let's pick it up a little bit there about the ways in which the French came to sort of understand Davis. So you write, when she was a child, Angela Davis found a way to be free by speaking French. Today, French speakers turn to her for their own myth of freedom. A myth, said Claude Lévi-Strauss, is a story made up of a few essential elements. African-American girl studying in France acquires revolutionary wisdom from the decolonization struggles and returns home to challenge the powers that be and triumph over her enemies. Now, I know one of the things that you're doing, and we've heard this throughout the interview in terms of your work, is you're really trying to complicate myths and dreams. And you're doing so as well in Dreaming in French by recounting the biographies that restores to these quintessentially American women's lives their French connection. So tell us a little bit more about how your story of Angela Davis is really different from that French myth about Angela Davis.
What I came to understand when I went into the archives was what a perfect moment it was when Angela Davis came on the French political scene. In other words, and I don't have time to go into the whole Marin County courtroom hostage situation, but she had gone underground. She went on trial for kidnapping and murder in connection with this Jonathan Jackson hostage situation. She was accused of having supplied the guns that were used in that hostage takeover and murder. She was defended by the French Communist Party. And I like to joke that if I were ever on trial for murder, I would want that French Communist Party from the 1970s on my side. They were incredibly well organized. I mean, I don't think we've seen the likes of that since in France or anywhere else. She appeared on the scene just as the French Communists were trying to liberalize in the early 70s. They were trying to make coalition with the Socialist Party. And here was this woman. She was American. Of course, it was great for the French Communists to defend an American. She was black. She was a philosopher. She spoke perfect French. She was their mascot for bringing the French Communist Party beyond Stalinism. Now, for her, on the other hand, and she would acknowledge, and I think her sister acknowledged at the time in public speeches, that never anywhere else in Europe had they seen the kind of outpouring of sympathy. There are cartons of letters and postcards that she got in an archive at Stanford that are just fascinating. And you see especially from a lot of people of color in France, people from the Antilles, how important she was to them symbolically. I don't think France is as important for Angela Davis as Angela Davis is important for France. I mean, she is really somebody who, since that imprisonment and her acquittal, she has really put all her energy into fighting the industrial prison system, which she considers the modern institution of slavery. I think that her thinking about prisons was nourished by French thinkers like Foucault, but probably Foucault took as much, if not more, from her in his own thinking about discipline and punishment, took more from her than she took from him. And when you think about Angela Davis teaching Foucault at Santa Cruz, it's nice to imagine the circle closing.
And I guess also part of the way in which you complicate the French myth is by talking about the background story, about the fact that she was already from this very educated family, that she had spent time in a boarding school, that she was learning French and then had this relationship with this German and began to learn German, and this is part of what brought her to Germany. So it's a transnational story with a much fuller picture of life that helps us to understand why Angela Davis became the woman that she did and how the concerns that animate her post-war political activism were shaped.
What you're talking about, too, is an American stereotype that a radical from the 60s, of course, would have to be in rebellion and have a really bad relationship to their family. And of the three women I write about, clearly Angela Davis is the one with the most loving, supportive family.
So since you bring up stereotypes, I guess the last question that I want to talk to you about is these kind of stereotypes that circulate across the Atlantic between France and America today. I sometimes feel today like teaching about France is like teaching about Russia during the Cold War.
And it seems That's a great question.
it seems to work on a two-way street. So you say that for the French, America is also a kind of cipher, positive or negative, for France's own aspirations. And we could say exactly the same thing about France for Americans today, that it's a kind of mirror image. How have France and America become mirror images of one another, stereotyping in a way that shapes some of the politics we've seen since the war in Iraq?
You know, what they always say is this is a love affair kind of doomed because both countries aspire to being the leaders of a kind of universalism, that universalism is French. It comes out of the Enlightenment. And the Americans would say the same thing. So both countries think that they set the agenda for the truth. And that's a pretty fierce competition where no one is going to win. The two countries have been so close, even involved in each other's revolutions. And I mean, the fact that Jackie Kennedy tried to redo the White House and discovered that all the furniture in it was French, I mean, just everywhere you go, there is so much complicity, competition, love, resentment between these two countries. I see the fortunes of the French-American relationship wax and wane with events. I mean, there was the French fries period. There was actually a period where enrollment in classes went down. Then suddenly things went up again. And what I find, at least about teaching French, is that there is a deep passion for French literature. This literature where in every century you have not just one, but 10, 15 writers of immense importance that we still read today with pleasure. So it's hard to dismiss all of that tradition. And I think the thing is that the study of French in this country is not about language proficiency. It's about literature, culture, and history.
And that's just such a great way to end, because part of what you've been insisting on over and over again is that literature, culture, and history demands a certain discipline, a certain kind of attention to specificities and to intricacies and to complexities. And for that, I'm really so appreciative that you could spend a little time with us today on Counterpoint.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item, where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.